number one fan has just listened to the second time of Skylark of Space. Thank you so very much.
Go tape.
Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
And it is Tuesday, the 2nd of May, in the glorious future year of 2023. I certainly hope that you had a good International Labor Day yesterday, and if at all possible, didn't work. I went for a long walk in the evening, although it was rainy. Now, what do I have for you today? Well, first priority is, of course, to finish one of Marshall Bruser's vignettes in Nuclear Medicine, which we were into last time. And it's a pretty darn good vignette. And, of course, we also have, there's a vignette that follows that one, titled The True History of Atomic Energy Revealed, which is a fairly brief one and pretty good. In case you wonder what this noise is in the background, I'm eating an ice cream cone that I bought about 20 minutes ago. I didn't finish it yet. Okay, now, where are we at? Yes. Here. I wouldn't necessarily call it German ice cream. I buy it from an Italian who calls it gelato. Crema gelato da Giacomo. Downtown somewhere, there's a guy who calls himself Der Verruchte Eismacher, the crazy ice cream maker. So it takes me a little longer to type the metadata because I got one handful. I ought to get the ice cream in dishes and just use my great horn spoon. Actually, it's a small horn spoon. That's the whole point. It's a suitable size for eating ice cream. Although, in fact, it was made for eggs. The Germans have a habit of eating their eggs with spoons made of either horn or bone. Because, as will immediately occur to you, the sulfur in eggs will tarnish the silver spoon. Okay. Let's read. Now, my little post-it flag here tells me that I left off with number 8 last time, But I'll go back and start again with number 7 of his reasons for using radioisotopes in medicine. 7. Some radioisotope tests take less time. An image produced on a rectilinear scanner in 10 minutes may be produced by a radioisotope camera in 2 minutes. This could be a significant difference physiologically, in which case 2 minutes is still much too long. If it is not physiologically significant, and if it takes 15 or 20 minutes to set up the patient properly, then the time saved is not of great economic importance. 2 slow rectilinear systems might be a bargain compared with 1 fast camera system. It takes about 10 minutes to set up a patient and perform a thyroid uptake, 24 hours post-administration. The 8 to 72-hour gold scan might take less than an hour's laboratory time. Administering the isotope for most long-term tests does not involve laboratory time. Tests done 10, 20, or 30 minutes post-injection do take up laboratory time. The cardiac output measure, first performed by Prinzmetal in 1949, did not take much instrument recording time. Now it takes less than 5 minutes of actual recording. However, setting up the patient for the recording takes at least a half hour of laboratory time, and interpreting the record takes still longer. There is a tremendous saving of time over the old FIC dye method, but regardless of the fact that the cardiac output measurement looks at only one heartbeat, it can still be more than an instantaneous use of equipment. In spite of all my hedging, in general, external counting procedures take less time than chemical sampling procedures. Where samples must be taken, a radiochemical manipulation is usually faster than a non-radioactive chemical procedure. A specialty here in Germany that I've never seen in America is something they call spaghetti ice, where you press the ice cream through a plate with little holes in it, and it makes like noodles. Sometimes this is vanilla, and they put strawberry jam on it so it looks like spaghetti sauce, but you can get it made out of anything, really. Number 8. Some radioisotope tests are less expensive. The in vitro STAR-T3 test, done on an occasional patient, might be quite expensive. But since laboratories are doing anywhere from 100 to more than 1,000 STAR-T3 tests each month, the test is generally considered one of the least expensive of all the radioisotope tests. The cost of the radioactive drug is small. The 8-day half-life minimizes wastage. The initial cost of equipment is probably the least expensive of any radioisotope procedure. When amortized over a very large number of tests, equipment cost and maintenance is minute. The total technician time involved in the test is only a few minutes per test. The patient does not appear in the laboratory, automatically time and money saving. The professional supervision need be nothing more than a post facto review of the log of the day's results. The pretest calibration need be done only once a day as a simple routine. Because of the very low doses of radioiodine used, health physics cleanup, even where very large numbers of tests are done, is nothing more than routine housekeeping. No professional interpretation is necessary, except by the physician who ordered the test, but this is not a laboratory cost. And rarely is there a professional consultation cost. Probably the most expensive item in the entire procedure is the administrative overhead. The same cannot be said for all of the radioisotope procedures. Radioisotope ventriculography uses a high-cost drug, very expensive equipment, the services of a neurosurgeon for the injection, the use of multiple technicians. There is a complex and time-consuming professional interpretation. Professional consultation is a part of the procedure. However, the increased cost over the comparable X-ray procedure is balanced by the fact that it is less dangerous to perform. The excessive cost of the pulmonary embolism scanning radiopharmaceutical is balanced by the amount of information obtained and the ease of understanding the information. Then, to repeat, why use radioisotopes? If we are ever able, and this admittedly will be difficult, to get rid of the excessive secretarial and stenographic costs of filling out forms for special licenses, special inspections, special and often unnecessary calibrations of equipment, special and usually unnecessary refinements of instrumentation, special and invariably unnecessary health physics procedures, the cost of a radioisotope laboratory is going to become one of the least expensive of all medical procedures. We are paying today for the decade of radiation hysteria that to a considerable extent was deliberately anti-medical. We are also paying today for the post-atom bomb glamorizing of nuclear physics, for a physical precision that is biologically ridiculous. During the early 1950s, when I was involved in Cobalt-60 teletherapy machine design, no matter what press releases were handed out, the newspapers still had us inventing a new cancer cure. There was nothing new about the radiation. The million-volt X-ray machines had preceded us by a quarter century. There were no new biological principles involved. Our main concern was to meet the demands of radiotherapists who had built their techniques on a half-century's history of radiotherapy. Even the name teletherapy, which I was accused of making up, I swiped from a German article printed in 1906. The only justification for the use of the radioisotope was economic. Cobalt-60 teletherapy was accepted and became popular among radiotherapists because it was the poor man's supervoltage. The same situation exists with most radioisotope tests. A few are more accurate than chemical tests, but usually this is not true. Some of the radioisotope tests are more informative, some are less dangerous, and some are easier to do or to understand than the counterpart non-radioisotope test. But for every test that has one of these advantages, there are others with disadvantages. Usually, the common thread that runs through all the radioisotope procedures, and there are a number of violent exceptions to this, is that for the same amount of information, the radioisotope test is more economical than its non-radioisotope counterpart. This might not be a wholly good situation. If physicians, instrument makers, and pharmaceutical houses cannot make a reasonable amount of money with radioisotopes, nuclear medicine will disappear. In general, I think the best answer to the question, implied by the title, is that the use of radioisotopes is an inexpensive way to get an awful lot of information. Okay, this next one is great. Number 12, The True History of Atomic Energy Revealed. Many centuries ago, the new Egyptian pharaohs used to chisel the old Egyptian pharaoh's name off all the monuments. They thought they could change history, but we found them out. We have some awfully big chisels ourselves, but I think we ought to let history alone. I'm not saying the other stories are wrong. I'm just saying I'm the only one telling the truth. Oh yeah, this is a good one. The Russians haven't published their version of the history of the atomic age yet, but when they do, it will undoubtedly be written in Russian. I intend to buy a copy of the translation just to see if anyone can think up a new story. Three histories of latter-day atomic energy have recently been published. The New World, 1939-1946. By R.G. Hewlett and O.E. Anderson, Jr. Britain and Atomic Energy, 1939-1945, by Margaret Gowing. and The Atomic Adventure by Bertrand Goldschmidt. No dates mentioned. All three describe the same events, but there the resemblance ends. The New World 1939-1946 is the American version. The Atomic Energy Commission found the best American historians that money could buy, gave them all the out-of-date classified documents that could be dug up, and paid them to be uncensored. It turns out that the Americans are the good guys. The English, French, and Russians are bad guys. Germany, Italy, and Luxembourg are held over for Volume 2. Britain and Atomic Energy 1939-1945 is the British version. The Atomic Energy Authority found the best British historian that money could buy, gave her all the out-of-date classified documents that could be dug up, and paid her to be uncensored. It turns out that the English are the good guys. The Americans, French, and Russians are bad guys. Germany, Italy, and Luxembourg are held over for Volume 2. There was no France during the period in question, so the French version had to be a personal memoir. It turns out that the good guys are all French. The Americans spit at the Frenchman, the English slapped his face, Italy and Luxembourg are held over for Volume 2. China already has the bomb and is just looking for the proper pictographs to relate the whole business to gunpowder. India has the good old American know-how. They revealed the Atoms for Peace H-bomb secret. But anyway, good old American businessmen trying to meet a payroll will believe anything written in Sanskrit. If Israel hasn't got a bomb history yet, it's because they're lazy. Japan can't build an atom bomb because Douglas MacArthur threw all their cyclotrons into the ocean. No matter what language you read, the intellectual progenitor of all the Atomic Energy Commissions was the Manhattan District. The Manhattan District was only accomplishing what they had stolen. That's a harsh word, I'd better use borrowed, from the English Maud Committee, and the Maud Committee was just expanding on the ideas of the recently deceased Lord Rutherford. Rutherford had invented the neutron 12 years before its discovery, but even he put the idea of atomic energy way back to the beginning of the 20th century, when he made a mistake in calculating the amount of energy that could be released by atomic disintegration. But this faulty calculation of the energy in an atom really goes back a little further to where he got the idea in the first place that there had to be a transmutation. The proper and dignified histories of science all put the beginnings of atomic energy back to when Rutherford moved to McGill University in Montreal and discovered the production of the radioactive gas thoron from thorium. The big question then is, how did he get this idea? The true story will never be told in history books, because it involves a man who was not even a physicist, and because it was caused by a woman, and involves sex. Back in 1896, when Becquerel made a mistake in deciding that Mr. Röntgen's rays came from the fluorescence on an X-ray tube, and therefore the fluorescence in uranium also had to give out rays, J.J. Thomson decided that because Mr. Röntgen's rays produced ionization, then Mr. Becquerel's rays also had to produce ionization. Proof of this supposition was a lot of tedious work, and so J.J. put one of his students, Ernest Rutherford, on to measuring the ionization of Mr. Becquerel's rays. But uranium then was a useless element, and had only one function, to seal off the top end of the periodic table of the elements. It was already known that besides uranium, thorium was also radioactive. The Curies had just coined the word radioactive, only they spelled it in French. And Rutherford had made up a wonderful experiment. He put a layer of thorium oxide in an open metal dish, and put a thin wire about 2 inches over the dish. He attached the wire to one pole of a battery, and the metal dish to the other pole, to capture some of the ions produced by the radioactivity. He found that when the wire was attached to one pole of the battery, the wire became intensely radioactive. When it was attached to the other pole of the battery, there was no radioactivity at all. When he disconnected the battery completely, there was only a medium amount of radioactivity on the wire. This was a wonderful experiment, only most of the time it didn't work. When an experimental physicist has a perfect experiment that doesn't work, there is obviously something wrong with the instruments, and the thing he does is to call in an appliance repair man. Rutherford was a brand new professor at McGill. A colleague of his, Robert Bowie Owens, also brand new, was the professor of electrical engineering. After all, there was a battery attached to the experiment, and therefore it was a problem in electrical engineering. Rutherford conned Owens into finding out what was going wrong with the experiment. Because there were no directions to read and follow, Owens had to repeat the experiment. At this point, I have to deviate a little bit from the story in order to explain some anatomy. Because the human walks upright on two legs, there has to be a bone called the pelvis to keep the legs separated. Quite properly, the leg bones grow straight up from the ground, and then bend inwards to meet the pelvic bone at a thing called the acetabulum. Among Latin scholars, it's called the hip joint. In the female of the species, the pelvic bone, in addition to its function of keeping the legs apart, has a hole right in the middle, which is used mainly by obstetricians. But this means that the acetabula have to be quite far apart. Because of the wide acetabular spacing, the female of the species cannot properly be said to walk upright, but rather waddles like a duck. When viewed from behind, the waddling motion used by the semi-matured female in the mating ritual elicits from the male a long, low, two-noted expulsion of air called the wolf whistle. It is a sort of conservationist countersign expressing deep appreciation for the glories of nature. Now, in the 1890s, the female of the species did not wear the abbreviated loincloth, which is currently fashionable, but wore a full-bodied skirt containing many yards of material that extended all the way to the floor. When waddling like a duck, the skirts of the female swished back and forth, causing a considerable micrometeorological trade wind. This rather detailed anatomical explanation is important because nuclear physics and the wolf whistle were born at the same time. When Owens repeated Rutherford's experiment the first time, it worked perfectly. But since he was academically inclined, he repeated the entire experiment. This time, while exposing the wire to the thorium salts, his secretary walked through the laboratory with skirts a-swishing. Owens emitted the long, low wolf whistle and then refocused his attention on the experiment. On this second trial, the experiment did not work properly. Following the well-accepted physical principle that if an experiment can't be done right in the first place, you can always repeat it many times and use an average for the answer, Owens repeated the experiment again and again. Finally, he noticed that every time the secretary walked through the laboratory, the experiment didn't work, but when she was on her coffee break, the experiment did work. By setting up controlled conditions on further repetitions, he found that just the emission of the wolf whistle by itself, even without the passing of the secretary, was sufficient to cause a deviation in the results. Eventually, it became apparent to Owens that there was nothing wrong with the experiment. All he had to do was put the dish of thorium oxide in a closed box, and it worked perfectly every time. The deviations were due to drafts in the laboratory. By this time, the summer vacation was due. Owens gave his results to Rutherford with a number of snide remarks on the expulsion of gases and went back to visit Cambridge, England, in order to pursue his conservationist inclinations. Rutherford, however, was about to get married in another year, and he had to keep working to earn money to go all the way back home to New Zealand to pick up his bride. But this gave him the leisure necessary to work out an explanation for the rapid buildup and disappearance of the gas formed by the thorium oxide. To do this, he invented the half-life concept. But to explain the half-life business, he had to invent transmutation. But to explain the transmutation, he had to modify J.J. Thomson's concept of the atom and incidentally give some impetus to Sir William Crookes' 1888 idea of meta-elements, which Fiennes renamed pleiades, which Todd renamed isotopes, which Soddy latched onto. For an experimental physicist, the whole business was getting awfully theoretical. Finally, by 1920, Rutherford had to invent a neutron, which wasn't found for another 12 years, to explain the transmutation. Rutherford gave this third explanation of the second explanation of the first explanation in a lecture that was published in English, and a couple of Germans and a couple of Frenchmen didn't bother to read it, so a student of Rutherford's had to discover the neutron. This opened the way to the development of an atomic weapon by England. By this time, they were in another war, and they couldn't afford the time, money, or space to develop it. Therefore, the Americans set up the Manhattan District, which hired an Italian physicist to make some plutonium that had been postulated by a couple of Frenchmen and independently discovered by a couple of Americans. One of the Americans, an ex-chemist, now runs the Automatic Energy Company in Washington. A little poke at Glenn Seaborg there. Incidentally, the Americans didn't use the Italians' nuclear reactor to discover the transuranic elements like plutonium because the reactor hadn't been built yet. They had to use an American cyclotron, which would later on be mathematically verified as possible by a Russian. Because of Otto Hahn's, a German, fundamental distrust of anything smacking of theoretical physics, these new transuranic elements had to be chemically verified. A lot of modern chemistry ultimately can be traced back to a wolf whistle in 1898. The baby brother of the cyclotron that made the transuranic elements also made phosphorus-32. Small amounts of phosphorus-32 had already been made on a radium-beryllium source, invented by a couple of Germans, owned by a Dane but used by a Hungarian who was a Swedish citizen. Applying some principles he had learned in an English laboratory with a Viennese colleague. By a slight Madison Avenue twist, this radioisotope became a cancer cure, which was undoubtedly a peaceful use of atomic energy, and therefore a later Atomic Energy Commission first applied the peaceful atom to make a nuclear submarine. If this sounds slightly confusing, all you have to remember is that everything in nuclear physics traces its way back to the wolf whistle. Some people may not think this story is true because it isn't dignified and sober-sided, however it can all be verified. The original Rutherford Owens article is in the Transactions of the Royal Society of Canada in 1899. A.S. Eve tells the story in his biography of Rutherford. J.J. Thompson tells the story in his Recollections. T.W. Chalmers tells the story in his Short History of Radioactivity. A. Romer tells the story in his Commentary on the Discovery of Radioactivity and Transmutation. Dover Publications, 1964. The only part of the story that is not easily verifiable is the part about Owens' secretary. I had never thought of attempting to get literary verification, because this part was told to me as a bedtime story when I was a very little boy, because, after all, I thought everybody knew Owen's secretary was my mother. Well, how do you like that? Now, this next piece, the next vignette, number 13, is very long. And I'm not actually going to start reading it yet. No, indeed, I am instead going to begin reading something else. Sauerhoff doesn't know quite what to make of that story. I'm not sure anyone knows quite what to make of that story. So, a few weeks back, I inserted in my A Step Farther Out a brief piece from Physics World from January of 1989 describing the violent attack on an atomic energy exhibit in Berlin, an exhibit which was set up to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the discovery of fission at the end of 1938. And it said, the clipping that I have has a little notation that says, "See opinion article, page 10. And I sent an email off just yesterday to the editors of Physics World, asking if they could possibly supply me with that opinion piece. And they did. They came through. So now I'm going to read it for you. The title of the piece is "Nuclear Power is Green Power." And it comes from John Gittus, Director, Communication and Information, United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority. Considering that Gittus, I mean, sounds like a rather rude name for a person in Britain, but there's a little photograph of him, and he looks like a typical morose Britisher. And then there's a photograph of the Dunray site in Scotland, captioned, "The Dunray Fast Breeder, a cut too soon?" So let me read you the piece, which is a whole page, A4 size page, 3 columns. "Anybody who has seen the devastation created in the American Corn Belt by the 1988 drought cannot fail to be impressed by the potential of the greenhouse effect drastically to change our way of life on Earth. If this drought is indeed one of the consequences of global warming, then we can expect worse and more frequent catastrophes of this magnitude in the coming decades. What is to be done about it? One positive step is to make greater use of nuclear energy. The use of electricity is in any case increasing in developed countries, and if that electricity is not generated by burning fossil fuel, then we shall produce substantial reductions in the production of carbon dioxide, a contributor to the greenhouse effect. About 1/7 of the world's electricity is nuclear. Already about 1/7 of the world's electricity is nuclear, equivalent to a reduction of about 2 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the 20 to 25 billion tons that the world's energy demands are injecting every year into the atmosphere. One or two countries, notably France, now generate most of their electricity from nuclear power stations, following a decision taken about 15 years ago in the wake of the first oil shock. What France has done, other countries, such as the United Kingdom, could achieve as well. We have comparable technical abilities and resources at our disposal, and this means that the developed world could turn from fossil electricity to nuclear electricity in a matter of decades. Nuclear energy is not limited to displacing fuels for electricity. It can also substitute for primary energy. This is either accomplished by using electricity instead of primary energy, as in steelmaking, or by the use of high-temperature nuclear reactors. The latter can produce hot gases that are as effective in industrial processes as are the hot gases produced by burning fossil fuel. Suitable prototype high-temperature reactors have already been commissioned in West Germany and the USA, and other countries such as the USSR and China are showing interest. Pressurized water reactors have also been used for heating in combined heat and power applications in Russia. However, a major swing to nuclear power would put severe strains on the world's uranium resources, which could run out in a few decades, as current thermal reactors use only about 1% of natural uranium. This would be countered by turning to the fast breeder reactor that enables most of the natural uranium to be used, so providing an energy resource that would suffice for centuries, easily outlasting fossil fuel. Fortunately, fast reactor technology is at a healthy stage of development. Many countries, including the United Kingdom, have prototypes of liquid metal-cooled fast reactors, and large, commercial-sized lead stations are already operating in France and in the USSR. A major collaborative project for the commercial development of the system is expected to be signed early next year by a number of European countries, including the UK. The only question remaining is when the system will be required. The recent British government decision to reduce its funding of fast reactor development was taken against a background of a slow worldwide buildup of nuclear power. Greenhouse warming may be the factor that leads to a more rapid need. Public opinion is seen as an obstacle to the increasing use of nuclear energy in the United Kingdom by some people. However, a recent opinion survey conducted for British Nuclear Fuels Limited showed that more than 3/4 of the people expected nuclear power to play a much more important role in the future. The same outcome occurred when similar questions were put recently in the USA and in Canada. See Atom Magazine, November 1988. The public expects nuclear energy to come into wider use. They certainly have concerns about nuclear safety at present, but the message is clear. The public expects these safety issues to be resolved and a wider use of nuclear energy in future. Concerns are also expressed frequently about the high costs of decommissioning, reprocessing, and radioactive waste disposal. The costs of all these activities are included in the prices that are paid by the consumer for nuclear electricity. However, often large sums of money are quoted out of context, such as £4 billion to decommission Magnox stations, giving the false impression that a large item unprovided for is being hidden. Moreover, despite allegations to the contrary, considerable experience has been gained on decommissioning nuclear reactors, and, in the UK, the carefully planned decommissioning of the advanced gas-cooled reactor at Windscale is adding substantially to that experience. The same is true of radioactive waste disposal, where the major issue facing the industry is that of political and public acceptance of disposal proposals. While no one wants to swap one large environmental problem for another, the issues associated with nuclear power are vastly different from the disaster that faces the world should global warming become a reality. I would say, then, that the climate for greater use of nuclear energy, as a way of combating the greenhouse effect, is not unfavorable. As the impact of global warming on the climate becomes more marked, I would expect public opinion to swing firmly behind nuclear energy. Conservation of energy will also be very important. However, it is not the only solution. We have to have energy before we can conserve it. We should not continue to burn fossil fuels on such an enormous scale as a source of energy. The renewables will also play an increased role. Hydropower, the wind, waves and tides, together with solar energy and geothermal energy, all need to be considered and tapped whenever this is economic and feasible. Present indications are that in the United Kingdom, perhaps another 10-15% of our energy could come from the renewables. In some other countries, renewables already play a major role, but a great deal depends on local conditions. Worldwide, if we are to come to grips with global warming, then there is no substitute for a larger use of nuclear power. There is little time in which to get this message across. Some recent predictions suggest that major increases in global temperature, several degrees Celsius, will occur by the middle of next century, together with very severe climatic consequences if we continue on our present course. So I thought I would give you that there. And then we will return to Marshall Brucer and his vignettes in nuclear medicine. With number 13, how much? As I say, this is a long one. I just got a lot of tabular data. A friend of mine gave me a piece of Trinitite as a gift. A hospital in... So, yes, the title is $how much? Or just, how much? Maybe, how much money? You've lost the Trinitite that you had. Well, you should be able to find it again with a Geiger counter. Maybe that's not helpful advice. A hospital administrator I know, who gets his kicks out of seeing the hospital books balanced at the end of the year, recently got a call from his business manager. How much do we charge for a thyroid scan? Publicity on the new radioisotope laboratory was over. Questions of patient benefits and advances in medical science were no longer to the point. The billing clerk had asked the business manager, not a complex question about the diagnostic value of a test, but simply, what numbers do I type after the dollar sign on the patient's bill? The hospital administrator said, I'll call you right back, and then called the laboratory clerk. The laboratory clerk said, I'll call you right back, and then called the laboratory technician. The laboratory technician said, I'll call you right back, and called the laboratory physician. The laboratory physician said, I'll call you right back, and then called a friend of his in a neighboring hospital who was also doing thyroid scans. How much do you charge for a thyroid scan? Asked the first laboratory director. $50, said the second laboratory director. Why? Asked the first laboratory director, who occasionally had to justify a charge to an unfeeling board of trustees of businessmen unimpressed by whimsy. Because that's what Joe said he charged in Umpha City. It turned out that Joe charged $50 because that's what a colleague in another city charged. The chain of decision could be traced back to a laboratory director who had bought and prepared an Oak Ridge product in an early 1950 economy at inflated AEC prices, using an instrument costing a third of a present-day instrument, operated by a technician untrained in the procedure, and with no professional supervision, because the professional supervisors were the technicians at that time, during a radiation hysteria that made health physics enormously expensive, and with administrative overhead paid by a government grant. During the late 1950s and the early 1960s, how much do you charge a patient was a serious question. When nuclear medicine was just beginning, diagnostic tests were research problems, largely paid for by government grant. Those tests that did cost the hospital paid off in prestige. After nuclear medicine lost its glamour and started to become a workhorse during the early 1960s, there were many attempts to put costs and billing on a reasonably intelligent footing. The American College of Radiology, and later the College of American Pathologists, published scales of relative values that included values for radioisotope tests. The California State and the New York State Medical Societies usually were in reasonable agreement on their relative value scales. In fact, in some cases you wonder who was copying from whom, because mistakes were copied right along with the numbers. For example, you can do a thyroid scan without a thyroid uptake. Would any physician in good conscience attempt an interpretation? Also, in New York, you can do a liver scan for the same price as a thyroid scan. In the pathologist's list, the iodine-131 uptake with a single determination costs exactly the same as multiple determinations of iodine-131 uptake. In non-pathology laboratories, somebody might get the impression that either the single is paying through the nose or the multiple is getting something for nothing, but maybe this is just a way to encourage multiple tests. One quickly gets the impression, from the radiologist's scale, that whoever made the final decision had never been in a radioisotope laboratory. Whether it is pathology or radiology service, in New York or California, the day of the government grant for possessing a microcuriate of iodine has almost passed. The laboratory has to earn its keep or it goes out of business. Since most of us pay technicians by the hour, a test that takes 2 hours to perform costs more than a test that can be done in 10 minutes. Because the radiopharmaceutical houses selfishly demand payment for their services, when a radiopharmaceutical costs $45 per dose, we can't charge $30 for the test, which, incidentally, is still being done. The cost of a drug. When radioisotopes first entered medicine, drug cost was a large consideration. When pharmaceutical houses first began to prepare radioactive pharmaceuticals, each spent months of administrative, scientific, and technical time to produce the first dose for sale. Naturally, this initial cost was spread over a large series of individual doses. Once paid for, the pharmaceutical house charge could be reduced. In the meantime, improved production methods allowed a further reduction in cost. When a number of pharmaceutical houses were in operation, the element of competitive promotion reduced the cost per dose still further. However, much of the competitive phase of marketing a drug was built around the technique of performing a test rather than the charge for the radiopharmaceutical itself. By this time, the late 1950s, it was already evident that the cost of a pharmaceutical could be only a small fraction of the logical charge for a radioisotope test. Even more evident, catalog price is not the same as drug cost. A clinical laboratory performing one STAR-T3 test each week might pay as much as $2 for the radioisotope alone. Another laboratory, doing about 20 tests a week, would only pay $1. Still another laboratory, doing 100 or more tests each week, would only pay 70 cents apiece for the materials used. A laboratory doing one thyroid uptake each week will pay $1 for each iodine-131 diagnostic capsule. Another laboratory, doing 100 thyroid uptakes each week, will pay 65 cents per capsule. An even more difficult cost accounting procedure is true with the newer, short-lived compounds best prepared from a radiopharmaceutical cow. Technetium-99M, for example, used by a laboratory without a cow, can cost as much as $50 for one diagnostic dose. However, if the laboratory has a radioactive cow, it will pay about $150, for 1, 10, or 100 doses over a period of 1 week. From the standpoint of drug cost, a diagnostic test with technetium-99m can be either one of the most expensive or one of the least expensive diagnostic tests. Procedures that can use any of a number of different radiopharmaceuticals have an even more confusing cost picture. If we pay no attention, for the duration of this paragraph only, to the different preferences and indications for doing a brain scan with STAR-IHSA or Mercury-203 or Technetium-99m, the cost of the radiopharmaceutical has a tremendous range. Footnote: the asterisk in front of a symbol means a radioactive form of the element symbolized, e.g. STAR-IHSA means radioiodinated human serum albumin. Just to let you know. One dose of STAR-IHSA in a brain scan might cost anywhere from $2 to $13. It might be even cheaper with Mercury-197 at $1 to $10, or more expensive with Mercury-203 at $1.50 to $15. If STAR-IHSA-125 is used instead of STAR-IHSA-131, the $2 to $13 is now $5 to $90. If a combination brain scan is done using both technetium-99m and STAR-IHSA, the price ranges from $4 to $60 per dose. There are many specially prepared compounds that might be far better than any of the standard preparations. These, because they are still experimental, range up to $300 per dose. The pharmaceutical houses need not concern themselves with the indications for some of these brain scanning compounds, but they can be sure that no one compound meets the demands of all physicians for all patients. If the physician has plenty of time to wait for a brain scan, he can use a relatively inexpensive STAR-IHSA and inject 24 hours before a scan. Or the physician can prescribe an even less expensive Mercury-203 and do the scan within a few hours. But if he is really in a hurry, he can do the scan itself much faster by using a more expensive technetium-99m. The physician, who is more concerned with precision of detection than with a screening procedure, and precision in this instance is not necessarily a good thing, might want a double label or even a triple label, which takes more time and a more expensive set of radiopharmaceuticals. A physician who believes all the old wives' tales about radiation damage, in this case the federal government must be considered the mother of us all, must, if he is logical, use technetium-99m, which is either inexpensive or expensive, depending upon which state he lives in. In the advanced, from the standpoint of radioisotopes, state of California, the lowest dose radiation radiopharmaceutical is inexpensive in a large laboratory. In a backward, from the standpoint of radioisotopes state, such as Arizona, technetium-99m can be extremely expensive, unless, of course, the physician has already amortized the administrative costs of a federal authorization, which will make it a moderately expensive radiopharmaceutical. The size of the crystal, the state of the patient's health, the speed possible in the scanning mechanism, the number of projections that must be scanned on the same patient, the size of the hospital room available for scanning, the laboratory's scanning load, there are so many things that interlock to finally determine the cost of the dose to the patient, when none of which, incidentally, is under the control of the radiopharmaceutical house, that this cost cannot be put into a relative value scale. In my recommendations, I have sidestepped the problem by removing the cost of the drug from the scale. A relative economic value scale for radioisotope procedures. Many charges that must go into a cost estimate are sufficiently stable within any one laboratory that they can be put into the computation of a relative value scale. I don't know how any national, state, or even local organization can logically present a scale that fits the great variety of laboratory techniques for any one test. I can't do this either, but at least I can present a method for estimating a value to fit any laboratory situation. In Table 1, 5 different relative values for 6 fairly common radioisotope procedures are presented. The College of Pathology in 1963 stated that a STAR-T3 test was worth 4.0 points. The New York State Medical Society in 1965 felt it was worth only 2.0 points. I think it is the least expensive of procedures and use it as an index value. So, Table 1, a comparison of five relative economic value scales. The headings of the columns are College of Pathology 1963, College of Radiology 1963, State of California 1964, New York State Medical Society 1965, and Brucer Method 1967. And the rows are star T3, radioactive T3 in vitro uptake, TU, thyroid uptake, thyroid scan without uptake, thyroid TAS, thyroid area scan with uptake, LS, liver scan, BS, brain scan. The 24-hour thyroid uptake, I think, is close to 3 times more expensive to do than the star T3 test. Therefore, I go along with all of the other relative value scales in assigning it a value of 3.0. So the first row, radioactive T3 in vitro uptake, College of Pathology says 4.0, College of Radiology says 4, State of California says 3.5, New York State Medical Society says 2.0, Brucer says 1.0. Three of the scales assign a value to a thyroid scan without an uptake. I think it is a worthless procedure, and no legitimate laboratory should do it. We do liver, brain, spleen, and many other kinds of scans without knowing what the quantitative uptake is. We do this not because we want to, but because we have to. There is no way to quantitate an uptake for livers and brains. However, there is a way to quantitate a meaningful uptake in the thyroid, and this has so much to do with the interpretation of the scan that when we say thyroid scan, we automatically mean scan plus uptake. So he gives, College of Pathology gives that one. Yes. Now this is interesting. The economic value of the thyroid scan uptake ranges from a low of 7.0 on the California scale to a high of 10.0 on the pathologist scale. The 8.8 by my method includes a preliminary TAP scan, which I think is necessary, and an anterior projection only. If there is anything unusual about the anterior projection in the scanning technician's eyes, the technician is instructed to proceed immediately to a lateral oblique projection. A cost accountant would say the relative value should be increased to 9.6, but we do not sell scans. We sell a diagnostic test interpretation, whether it takes 1 or 50 scans. People are playing with the plus-plus thing in COM. TOBE is over 4,000. A liver scan listed at 20.0 points for the Colleges of Pathology and Radiology is only 8.0 points on both California and New York scales. I don't know how many projections of the liver are envisioned in any of these recommendations. In my own estimate, I include an anterior, a lateral, and a posterior projection when gold colloid is used. A first anterior, lateral, and a second anterior at about 1 hour are done when Rose-Bengal iodine-131 is used. The relative value for either test is 11.6. A brain scan has the same value as a liver scan in the college's scales. In the state's scales, the brain scan is more costly than the liver scan, and also more costly in New York than in California. But again, I do not know how many projections are visualized. On my own scale, I visualize 4 standard projections: vertical, anterior, posterior, and 1 lateral, with a relative value of 14.0. On many patients, the vertical projection cannot be done. The other lateral is substituted. The posterior projection, at a 10 to 15 degree angle with flexion, is difficult for many patients. 3 projections, anterior and both laterals, might have to suffice. But now, low-energy technetium-99m or mercury-197 cannot be used. Often a double isotope procedure or a combination with radiography is likely to be more valuable than multiple projections. I have no doubt that much of my own scale is based on strictly local conditions. However, the method of calculating anybody else's local conditions, while not exact, is simple. There are about 9 items that must be included in the computation. LCD says, you can only perform an operation on someone who is currently in the room. Very true. Although he may be talking about the plus-plus thing. Yes, SMJ changed that. Initially, you could plus-plus people whether they were in the room or not. A. Initial cost of equipment. A test done on equipment that cost $50,000 must be more expensive if the tests have to pay for the equipment than a test done on equipment costing less than $2,000. A STAR T3 counting system, for example, costs less than $2,000. Thyroid uptake equipment, on the other hand, costs about $3,000. Any scan is done on equipment that costs at least $12,000. Therefore, I have assigned a unit value of 1 to the STAR T3 test, a unit value of 2 to the thyroid uptake test, and a unit value of 8 to all the scans. But this is in one laboratory only. And so he's got a large table here, showing initial cost of equipment in kilobucks. Less than 2, 2 to 4, 5 to 6, 7 to 8, 9 to 10, 11 to 15, 16 to 20, 21 to 24, 25 to 30, 31 to 40, 41 to 50, and greater than 50. And basically, he puts STAR T3 in bucket 1, less than $2,000, TU in bucket 2, $2,000 to $4,000, and everything else in bucket 8, $11,000 to $15,000. The phrase initial cost of equipment is not just the manufacturer's list price, but includes such things as maintenance and the cost of permanent standards, plus all the hardware, glassware, and a fair share of the photographic equipment costs. Since there are so many variables and indeterminate factors, the cost scale is in units of kilobucks. 1 kilobuck is about $1,000, approximately, more or less. B. Technician time. The time it takes a technician to do a particular test is more variable from technician to technician than equipment is from laboratory to laboratory, but there are reasonable levels. For example, in almost any laboratory, the time it takes to do a single STAR T3 test is much less than 1 hour, primarily because single tests are very seldom done. Usually, this is done by a batch method of 10 to 30 tests at a time. I have assigned a unit value of 1. The thyroid uptake test, even when done by untrained technicians, can reach the peak of its accuracy, routine, not research, in much less than an hour. I assign thyroid uptake a value of 1. Because technician time is probably the most expensive of the items involved in establishing a relative value scale, I multiply the number of hours spent by 2 to fit a unit value scheme similar to that used for all of the other factors. A thyroid scan takes more time than an uptake. A liver scan takes still longer, but the difference in time between a liver and a thyroid scan isn't so much in setting up the instrument and the patient, it is in the larger size of the field and in the number of projections. A liver scan with colloidal gold 198 must always have 3 projections. A thyroid area scan usually has a rapid preliminary plus a definitive anterior projection. A brain scan, on the other hand, usually has a longer setup time and most often demands 4 projections. With increased training and experience of, and there's another table, like the previous one. With increased training and experience of technicians, it invariably takes less time to run a scan. Some patients are uncooperative. After all, some of them are sick people, and therefore it might take longer. Occasionally, and this is a very polite way of saying it, mistakes will occur in the technical procedure and the scan has to be repeated. If we were going to be completely logical about a cost accounting procedure, it would be necessary to take all of this into account. However, I am taking the generalized situation of a reasonably well-trained technician scanning a reasonably cooperative patient and only making a reasonable number of blunders. A laboratory that does multiple simultaneous projections should probably give technician time a lower unit value. A laboratory using technetium-99m routinely should probably assign a lower unit value. A laboratory that does only a single anterior projection of the liver should undoubtedly give a higher unit value to technician time, but a relative economic value scale is cost analysis only to a first approximation. You have been listening to Hear Now the Words on Anon Radio, a service of the SDF Public Access Unix System. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America, and I'm very likely to read them out over the air when I get back to the U.S. in late May. Also, I'm very likely to send you something back. If you like these broadcasts, please support them. PayPal.me/Prometheus Lives, Patreon.com/man_and_Adam, or Publius_Reads. And coming up next is Evolution Revolution with DJ Damaru. Take it away.